The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Everyone, I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. I'm broadcasting live from our studio in New York City and streaming and over the video, where you can watch it at progressiveradionetwork.com or GaryKnoll.com. We have an absolutely packed show today. As a follow-up to yesterday or last evening's special one-hour live broadcast on vaccines, their safety and efficacy, where we had Dr. Sherry Tenpenny and Dr. Meyer Eisenstein and Dr. Martin Feldman, myself in studio, and a whole lot of people listening all over the world, plus the premiere over the internet of our film Vaccine Nation, Autism Made in the USA. So many inquiries. My website, my Facebook page is packed with people talking about vaccines. So I'm setting aside three quarters of today's show specifically to talk about new information that you have not heard or read anywhere, some exclusive whistleblower information. I have four guests on, and Eileen Daneman will be talking about behind the scenes the green labeling of children in Indiana if they receive a vaccine, and if they don't, the kid can't go to school. What does this mean? Also, a personal story of miscarriage following a vaccine, and then the woman is forced to take a flu shot again after the miscarriage due to the vaccine the first time. Mandated flu vaccines to healthcare workers, brand new information, an economic crash to states that support that program. That's what will be created. And tagging healthcare workers in Michigan. So we have a lot of exclusive information. A special commentary. The world liberal opportunists made and how it is crashing. As many of you have heard, and this is from Chris Hedges from CommonDreams.org, as many of you have heard me state repeatedly, I believe that the problem today is that people believe that they can either go Democrat or Republican, or maybe the far end of the Republican to the Tea Party members supporting certain Republicans. That's only a small percentage of Tea Parties, but that will help us. None of that will help us. But the primary cause is not the Republicans. They have already been aligned with the corporate interest for a long time. It is the liberals. So the most comprehensive, in-depth, right-on commentary on why I'm hopeful that the Democrats and liberals will take a moment and in self-reflection look at what they've become. And then maybe you'll understand why many of us, myself included, no longer align with the historical liberal or democratic parties, but rather are now independent, progressive, even parts of the libertarian movement. And today, we'll refute with complete documentation that the vaccines were the primary cause of major diseases like tuberculosis being eliminated. That is not true. And we have the first really authoritative scientific report. You have not read it, seen it, or heard it before. I will break it today exclusively on this story. As you can see, a packed, packed show. Let us begin. On health and nutrition, magnesium can help prevent a sudden heart attack death. This is a major study by Patrick Massey, MD, PhD, and this was done at the Alexan Brothers Hospital Network. And what it shows is this, and I'll quote this in the Chicago Daily Herald. Magnesium is a mineral that is important for health, but it can help prevent sudden cardiac death. Sudden cardiac death is a leading cause of heart-related deaths, especially in people 40 and over. That's according to the CDC. More than 250,000 Americans die each year because of that sudden death. That's more than colon cancer, breast cancer, and prostate cancer and AIDS combined. the most common cause of this type of death, this sudden cardiac death, is believed to be a heart rhythm disorder, arrhythmia, or called ventricular fibrillation. Unfortunately, most people do not know if they are at risk. When the heart stops, cardiopulmonary resuscitation and immediate emergency medical care may be successful, but time is the essence. The key is in prevention. Magnesium is the answer. Magnesium is one of the most common elements in the human body and indeed the known universe. It is essential for life and therefore must be important. Hundreds of enzymes require magnesium, and it plays an important role in the production of energy and DNA function. And while magnesium may be commonly used for consumption, for example, if you take Epsom salts, you're getting magnesium, and it's soothing the muscles. It can also relax with an anti-inflammatory property. And interestingly, it can also stabilize abnormal nerve function and, given intravenously, can break a migraine headache. It can also help prevent heart arrhythmias associated with sudden cardiac death. And a recent medical study done at the University of Minnesota revealed that robust blood vessels levels of magnesium significantly reduced the risk of sudden cardiac death. It's a major study. It's important. And I'm suggesting 1,000 milligrams a day of magnesium from sulfate. Now, from the Institute for Cancer Research, can eating fresh produce really lower your blood pressure? If blood pressure control is all about limiting sodium, what has eating more vegetables and fruits got to do with better pressure? This is from the Chicago Daily Herald. Quote, limiting sodium is an important step to reducing the risk of high blood pressure and, for many people, to control it. However, eating lots of vegetables and fruits adds another layer of protection. This is what they're saying. In this major study called the ENCORE study, overweight men and women with above normal blood pressure achieved drops of 11 mmHg, 8 mmHg after just 4 months on a diet that limited sodium and fat and loaded up on vegetables and fruits. Why? Because of potassium, magnesium, and fiber. So that's what they're saying here. Now, just last week, in fact, not even a week ago, last Wednesday, we had our 1 year end of our health support group. All the participants who completed were at the center and we filmed them. At least one third showed a drop in blood pressure to a healthy level, dropping cholesterol, dropping the bad C-reactive protein and homocysteine, which are indicators that you're going to have a heart attack or stroke or cancer, dropping blood sugar into the normal range without medication. We had three diabetics who are no longer diagnosed as diabetic. They're off their meds. And we also had three people who had so much improvement in multiple sclerosis, they're no longer diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. So they all had something in common, taking a lot more of the fruits and vegetables each day than what is recommended, even in this study. It's what I call the laws of compensation. To the degree you have a problem, exceed the problem with healing nutrients. And the phytonutrients and the minerals and potassium are part of that. So every time you have yourself a glass of celery juice with cucumber and apple, you're flooding the body with potassium, eliminating the sodium, thinning the blood. And if you put some vitamin C in there, you'll have a better effect than aspirin at thinning the blood. But aspirin kills over 16,000 people a day, or aspirin-like compounds, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. In fact, it's up to 24,000 people a year die from that. If you took vitamin E and vitamin C together and coenzyme Q10, your blood naturally thins. No side effects. Speaking of coenzyme Q10, the latest research shows that it boosts energy, promotes heart health, and assists in weight loss. This was, a major study in nutrition and metabolism, and they found that by giving coenzyme Q10 each day, and not what I would consider a lot, I would consider a normal amount, 300 milligrams a day. They're considering 100 to be a lot. And for people with MS and Alzheimer's, it goes into the 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 milligrams a day. always taken with NADH. Here's what mainstream medicine says, quote, coenzyme Q10 is an amazing chemical cofactor which is required for every cell in the body to produce the energy we need to live. It's been shown to increase the level of energy to all muscles and especially important to cardiac function as it increases energy production at an optimal rate. Coenzyme Q10 provides the necessary energy to fuel our immune system as it mounts an attack against invading pathogens and improves the release of fat from storage by improving oxygen utilization. Our production of coenzyme Q10 decreases as we age, so it's necessary to supplement in order to benefit, and benefiting in energy, stronger immune system, and effective weight loss. That's the latest on health and nutrition. One last one, and again, this is all from Major Science. What they found here is they followed 4,800 Americans for 14 years, and they found that those that drank the most tea, white tea, green tea, black tea, oolong tea, were able to have better cognition. It protects the brains. Very good. And that was from the Alzheimer's Association International Conference on Alzheimer's Disease. So drink your tea or take supplements that have green tea in them. I'm suggesting above 200 milligrams a day. All good. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world. I'm Gary Nall. Our WMYE audience, listening to us on the official radio station of the City of New York, we thank you for tuning in. I'm concerned about how people are voting. I'm concerned that they will not seek out the true independent and progressive voter, the one who will seek to transform the problems, not to simply adjust to them. The one that will stop giving the too big to banks fail money and the titans of Wall Street, the hedge fund managers, the equity partnership groups, all the money they want in the world, monetizing our debt by a corrupt Federal Trade Commission, which should be abolished. None of this will change in the short term because people will be voting what they think is the answer to help them, either Republican, conservative, or Democrat and liberal. This message is for the liberals. The lunatic fringe of the Republican Party, which looks set to make sweeping gains in the midterm elections, is the direct result of a collapse of liberalism. It is the product of bankrupt liberal institutions, including the press, the church, universities, labor unions, arts, and the Democratic Party, and most important, the media. The legitimate rage being expressed by disenfranchised workers towards the college-educated liberal elite who abetted or did nothing to halt the corporate assault on the poor and the working class for the last 30 years is not misplaced. The liberal class is guilty. The liberal class, which continues to speak in the prim and obsolete language of policies and issues, refuse to act. It failed to defend traditional liberal values during the long night of corporate assault in exchange for its position of privilege and comfort in the corporate state. The virulent right-wing backlash we now experience is an expression of the liberal class's flagrant betrayal of the citizens. The liberal class, which once made piecemeal and incremental reforms possible, functioned traditionally as a safety valve. During the Great Depression, with the collapse of capitalism, it made possible the New Deal. During the turmoil of the 1960s, it provided legitimate channels within the system to express the discontent of the African Americans and the anti-war movement. But the liberal class, in our age of neo-feudalism, is now powerless. It offers nothing but empty rhetoric. It refuses to concede that power has been wrestled so efficiently from the hands of citizens by corporations that the Constitution and its guarantees of personal liberty are irrelevant. It does not act to mitigate the suffering of tens of millions of Americans who now make up a growing and desperate permanent underclass. And the disparity between the rhetoric of liberal values and the rapacious system of inverted totalitarianism the liberal class serves makes liberal elites, including Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, a legitimate source of public ridicule. The liberal class, whether in universities, the press, or the Democratic Party, insist on clinging to its privileges and comforts, even if it forces it to serve as an apologist for the expanding cruelty and exploitation carried out by the corporate state. Populations will endure repression from tyrants as long as these rulers continue to effectively manage and wield power. But human history has amply demonstrated that once those in positions of power become redundant and impotent, yet retain the trappings and privileges of power, they are swiftly and brutally discarded. An observer of the French Revolution looked and they hated the aristocracy, about to lose their power, far more than they hated them before. The increased hatred directed at the aristocratic class occurred because, as the aristocracy lost real power, there was no decline in their fortunes. As long as the liberal class had even limited influence, whether through the press or the legitimate process of legislation, liberals were tolerated and even respected. But once the liberal class lost all influence, it became a class of parasites. The liberal class, like the aristocrats of France, had no real function within the power elite, and the rising right-wing populace correctly asked why liberals should be tolerated when their rhetoric bears no relation to reality and their presence has no influence on power. Ah, did we forget that a majority of Americans voted the Democrats into power to get us out of the war? And did they do that? No, they did not. The death of the liberal class, however, is catastrophic for our democracy. It means there is no longer any check to a corporate apparatus designed to further enrich the power elite. It means we cannot halt the plundering of the nation by Wall Street, the Federal Reserve, the speculators, and the corporations. An ineffectual liberal class, in short, means there is no hope, however remote, of a correction or reversal through the political system and electoral politics. The liberals' disintegration ensures that the frustration and anger among the working and middle class will find expression in a rejection of traditional liberal institutions and the civilities of a liberal democracy. The very forces that co-opted the liberal class and are responsible for the impoverishment of the state will ironically reap benefits from the collapse. These corporate manipulators are busy channeling rage away from the corporate and military forces hollowing out the nation from the inside and are turning that anger towards the weak remnants of liberalism. It does not help our cause that liberals indeed turn their backs on the working and middle class. Or maybe I missed something. Maybe I missed the big marches in every city, the same people who galvanized the illegal workers to come out and to correctly state, look at us and see us as human beings, could not muster national campaigns for poverty, to keep people in their homes, to look at the poor child of a working middle-class person and say, does this child not deserve a roof over their head, food in their bellies? Bill Clinton could go to Haiti, yes, nobly so, but he could not go to the inner cities of our country and demand that poverty be addressed. And as a result, it is all sustained corruption. These movements rise to prominence by ridiculing and taunting the liberal class for its weakness, hypocrisy, and uselessness. The promises of these proto-fascist movements are fantastic and unrealistic, but their critiques of the liberal class are growing more in a truth. The liberal class, despite becoming an object of public scorn, still prefers the choreographed charade. Liberals decry, for example, the refusal of the Democratic Party to restore habeas corpus or halt the looting of the U.S. Treasury on behalf of Wall Street speculators, but continue to support a president who cravenly serves the interest like a lapdog of the corporate state. As long as the charade of Democratic participation is played, the liberal class does not have to act. It can maintain its privileged status. It can continue to live in a fictional world where democratic reform and reasonable government exist. It can pretend it has a voice and influence in the quarters of power, but the uselessness of the liberal class is not lost on the tens of millions of Americans who suffer the awful indignities of the corporate state. The death of the liberal class cuts citizens off from the mechanisms of power. Liberal institutions such as the church, the press, the university, the Democratic Party, and the art and labor unions once set the perimeters for limited self-criticism and small incremental reforms and offered hope for the piecemeal justice and change. The liberal class could decry the excesses of the state, work to mitigate them, and champion basic human rights. It posited itself as the conscience of the nation. It permitted the nation, through its appeal to public virtues and the public good, to define itself as being composed of a virtuous and even noble people. The liberal class was permitted a place within a capitalist democracy because it also vigorously discredited radicals within American society who openly defied the excesses of corporate capitalism and who denounced a political system run by and on behalf of corporations. The real enemy of the liberal class has never been Glenn Beck. Listen carefully to what I'm about to say. The real enemy of the liberal class would be a Noam Chomsky, who I support. The purging and silencing of independent radical thinkers as well as iconoclasts have robbed the liberal class of vitality. The liberal class has cut itself off from the roots of creative and bold thought, from those forces and thinkers who could have prevented the liberal class merging, like Bill Clinton, completely into a power elite. Liberals exude a tepid idealism utterly divorced from daily life. And since this is seen when we look at Barack Obama, and it is so palpably pathetic. Unions, organizations formerly steeped in the doctrine of class warfare and filled with those who sought broad social and political rights for the working class, have been transformed into domesticated junior partners of the capitalist class. Cars rolling out of Ford and GM plants in Michigan were said to have been made by Ford UAA, the United Auto Workers, and where unions still exist, more often than not, they have been reduced to simple bartering tools, if that. The social demands of unions early in the 20th century that gave the working class weekends off, the rights to strike, the 8-hour workday, and Social Security have been sabotaged, diminished, or abandoned. Universities, especially Harvard and Yale and Princeton, Stanford, who I am absolutely opposed to their elitism, and the breeding ground, the festering, the ulcerative cancer of ideologues that they have become, rapacious greed mills is all they are, especially in political science and economic departments, parrot the discredited ideology of unregulated capitalism and globalization. They have no new ideas. Artistic expression, along with most religious worship, is largely self-absorbed narcissism, meant to entertain without offense. The Democratic Party and the press have become courtiers to the power elite and corporate servants. Once the liberal class can no longer moderate and savage and greedily inclinations, the capitalist class, once, for example, labor unions are reduced to the role of bartering away wage increases and benefits, once public education is gutted and the press no longer gives a voice to the poor and the working class, liberals become as despised as the power elite they serve. The collapse of liberal institutions means that those outside the circles of power are trapped with no recourse. And this is why many Americans are turning in desperation towards idiotic right-wing populists who at least understand the power of hatred as a mobilizing force. The liberal class no longer holds within its ranks those who have the moral autonomy or physical courage to defy the power elites. The rebels, from Noam Chomsky to Sheldon Moylan to Ralph Nader, have been marginalized, shut out of the national debate, and expelled from liberal institutions. The liberal class lacks membership in the vision and fortitude to challenge dominant free market ideologies. It offers no ideological alternative. It remains a bound to the Democratic Party, a festering cancer that has betrayed every basic liberal principle, including universal health care, an end to our permanent war economy, a robust system of public education, a vigorous defense of civil liberties, job creation, the right to unionize, and welfare for the poor. And the left once dismissed the market as exploitive, so says Russell Jacoby. He writes, it now honors the market as rational and humane. The left once disdained mass culture as exploitive. Now it celebrates it as rebellious. The left once honored independent intellectuals as courageous. Now it sneers at them as elitist. The left once rejected pluralism as superficial. Now it worships it as profound. We are witnessing not simply a defeat of the left, but its conversion, perhaps inversion. And finally, capitalism, and especially corporate capitalism, unlike what I believe in, which is ethical capitalism, was once viewed as a system to be fought. But capitalism is no longer challenged in public discourse. Capitalist bosses, men such as Warren Buffett, George Soros, the darling of the left, and Donald Trump, pathetic as he is, are treated bizarrely as sages and celebrities, as if greed and manipulation has become the highest moral good, as Wall Street steals openly and with grins on their faces trillions of taxpayer dollars, as it perpetrates massive fraud to throw people out of their homes, as the ecosystem that sustains the planet is polluted and destroyed. We do not know what to do or say. We have been robbed of a vocabulary to describe reality. We decry the excesses of capitalism without demanding a dismantling of the corporate state. Our pathetic response is to be herded to political rallies by skillful publicists to shout inanities like, "Yes, we can." The liberal class is finished. Neither it nor its representatives will provide the leadership or resistance to halt our slide towards despotism. The liberal class prefers comfort and privilege. Just ask Al Gore if he ever gets off a massage table long enough to act like a human being. It will not halt the corporate assault or thwart the ascendancy of the corporate state. It is incapable of doing so. It will remain intolerant within its ranks of those who do. The liberal class now honors an unwritten quid pro quo, one set in place by Bill Clinton to cravenly serve corporate interest in exchange for money and power. Access and admittance into the halls of power. No different than some pathetically insecure person in college craving to get into a special elite guild, into a special sorority or fraternity. And what, my God, did they give away of their soul and conscience to do it? It is the gutless and bankrupt liberal class, even more than the bizarre collection of moral and intellectual trolls now running for office, who are our most perfidious opponents. Gary Nall, Chris Hedges, back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. A slight change in our schedule. We're not able to get our guests up. We will try later, but we have packed information to share with you. And just one postscript. So where does this leave us? It leaves us in looking for those who no longer feel that the right or left are the answer. Our society does not work on a right or left principle. It works on an up-to-down principle. We have allowed people in power or those seeking power to rule. It is now time that we took back that power. The way we do that will take time and organization. I am confident that the independents that outnumber the left and the right and the progressives within the independents will organize and then have transformational issues that they can bring into the public forum. This will take 2 to 4 years to do. We will have to go through the degradation and the evisceration and the privatizing and the corporatizing and the commodifying of virtually everything in the media, the institutions, and in our public halls in state, federal, and local government until all this human vermin is swept away. And that day will come. Now, a few thoughts. I told you that there is now a new program that has been created by a Dr. Raymond Omswam, Senior Advisor, First Nations Center. This is about immunization, and what I have in my hand is an immunization graph, the natural infectious disease declines. Now, what I'm going to show for the next few minutes here is that these are actual graphs of how many people were dying of a given disease prior to the vaccine. For example, the death rate in Canada from tuberculosis from 1880 was 200,000 a year. When the vaccine was introduced between 1948 and 54, let's just take an average of 1950, it was already down to about 5,000. So you had 95% reduction in the death rate of tuberculosis before the vaccine. Now let's take measles. At the highest, 1935, you had about 750,000. By the time the vaccine was introduced, live vaccine 1963 and activated 1964, it had gone from almost 800,000 to under 40,000. So you had a reduction of, again, over 95% before vaccine. In the United States, tuberculosis, 1900, about 190,000 died. When the vaccine was introduced, it was down to under 7,000, or again, 96% gone before the vaccine. Pertussis here. In 1918, you had 16,000 died, and when the vaccine was introduced in 1948, you were down to under about 1,800. So you had, again, 90% gone. Scarlet fever. You had to go from over 12,000 in 1910 to when the vaccine was introduced in 1958, down to almost none. It was almost completely gone before any vaccine was introduced. Influenza, 180,000 died in 1933, the first vaccine introduced and widely administered in the late 1980s, it was down by 98%. In England and Wales, pertussis death cases in children from 1850 to 1965. Pertussis vaccine began in 1950. Well, you had 1,400,000 dying in the 1850s and clear down by almost 98% before the first vaccine. You had the pertussis scurvy deaths going down 99% before the vaccine. England, Wales, measles death cases in children from 1850 to 1965, down 97%. And so I'm going through every single one of these vaccines. And then it deals with effectiveness. Children under the 2 of age, inactive influenza vaccine. This is based upon the Cochrane Collaborative Database of Systematic Reviews, and they took a look at how effective is the inactivated flu vaccine. The answer, zero. Not even 1%. Absolute zero. And then they took a look at the elderly. or people living in communities, groups, home. How effective is the influenza vaccine, the flu vaccine? Quote, from the Cochrane Group, little or no effectiveness. Again, zero. So just on immunization, we're looking at the actual science that shows it's not effective. How about the BCG or tuberculosis vaccine? Again, from randomized controlled trials in single BCG, repeated BCG, or combined. And here's what it says. Zero. Once again, no effectiveness at all. And that was for one group, and another group, it was zero. Mumps outbreak in highly vaccinated populations. Of 90% who were vaccinated, the group that had the highest incidence were in the vaccinated group. Chickenpox outbreak in highly vaccinated group and versus non-highly vaccinated group. In the unvaccinated group, it was 3%. In the those who did not get the chickenpox vaccine, it was 3%. Those who got the chickenpox vaccine, it was 97%. And this is how it goes with each one: measles, mumps, vaccine outbreaks in highly vaccinated populations, and only 1% in the unvaccinated, 99% in the vaccinated. So if you got vaccinated with the measles vaccine, you're 99% more likely to get the measles than if you didn't. Diphtheria, we have the records on that. Whooping cough, pertussis. And countries and numbers of vaccine mandated under 5 death rates. And once again, we see that the more vaccines they got, the higher the death rates. The less vaccines in Sweden, Japan, Finland, Norway, Switzerland, Australia, the more deaths. And guess which country has the most deaths in infants 5 or under? The United States. Why? We are the most vaccinated. To me, this is one of the single most important cumulative evidences in history that show you the complete fraud of our vaccine program. And this is not based upon speculation or politics or ideology. It's based upon science. And now we have the document, and Richard Gale and I are writing up a new report on this. It'll be posted within the next 48 hours. In the studio, joining me now is Kara Lee. Hi, Kara.
Good afternoon, Gary. Well, first of all, I wanted to say thank you to everyone who tuned in last night to the Autism Made in the USA release. I got a very nice email this morning, and I thought I would just briefly read it to you, Gary. It's from a woman named Ellen. She says she has a 17-year-old daughter with autism. She says that she's been saying it was the injection way before they were even talking about it. I would ask mothers in the waiting rooms when my daughter was getting occupational therapy. I was trying to figure out if others had the same story as I did. I'm so happy to hear that you made a movie, and I hope this increases people's awareness.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
We did have a very nice group of people. We had a whole hour discussion here in the studio afterwards where people all over the world tuned in and to go into this. And it's our contribution to letting people know that whether they vaccinate or not is their business. But at least they should know they do not have the science to support the safety and efficacy of any given vaccine for any given person. And this study this morning, which has no one seen before and no one knows about, clearly shows science is on our side to challenge it, not on their side to promote it.
And by the way, just one other announcement. We're still looking for day and night managers. Two separate positions, the day shift and the night shift. We need managers for Gary's Uptown Whole Foods location. We will be taking interviews tomorrow at 5 p.m. So Wednesday at 5. We'll be looking for people if you can come by, Gary.
Also, I'm going to be doing something else. I'm going to be hiring someone to work as a research editor on important projects. People who are interested in doing research have to be skilled in research and articulate and literate. Can contact you, and we'll give them a sample to see how well they do, and take it from there.
Yeah, you can give me a call at 646-926-5428, 646-926-5428.
And I'm also going to open our lines up now because we weren't able to make our connections because of the travel arrangements of one of the people who was going to be anchoring it. But we'll do that as soon as we're able to get them on, maybe later today. But I'm going to take that block of time and allow people to call in, share their thoughts and questions and issues. 888-874 4888. 888-874-4888. After all, this is the one radio program that deals with all the important issues, but from a more independent and progressive mindset. And I have more stuff to share with you, but I want to set time aside for people on the air. But before they call in, Carrie Lee, what else do you have? You have a whole stack of notes there from people.
I've got a whole stack of things. Well, one of the things that I brought in here that I thought was interesting is something that you talked about before, Gary, and it's about the global food crisis and how their predictions, scientists are predicting that we're going to reach record high levels in the cost of food. It says that raising food prices and shortages could really cause some instability in many countries where the cost of staple foods and vegetables have reached their highest level in a couple years, and scientists are predicting further widespread droughts and floods. Now, you know, obviously I think some of this has to do with some of the great weather changes that we've seen recently, but other than that, Gary, how do you think this is going to affect us, and what do you think is the cause of these rising food prices?
We will not see the food shortages in the United States. We'll simply see increases in any of the foods that come from the areas that have had droughts or flooding. But that is only part of the problem. The greater problem is that we're doing nothing to create long-term sustainable food production in countries. Let me give you an example. What you could do. In Pakistan, totally devastated, over 40 million people adversely affected. That's a lot of people. That's more than all the people living in California. You could put our aid that we now give to the Pakistani military, which is completely corrupt, and they steal it, and it goes into bank accounts. Now you've got all these guys with mansions on the French Riviera, or it goes to feed the... it goes into the Taliban, our actual enemy. That's how corrupt the Pakistani intelligence agency is. But instead, for about $500,000... you could build a large concrete above ground and hence stable from any flooding or drought emergency center. In there, you could have vaults, and these could be temperature-controlled vaults. And a vault could contain enough basic food in grains and legumes to support at least 5 million people in one single building. Then you could have another building that would be nothing but a gigantic series of showers and bathrooms and a clinic, because when people do not have clean water to drink or have proper sanitation, they're very susceptible to cholera and typhus and other conditions. Then you have another set of buildings that could be there, again, permanent buildings for short-term emergency housing for people who are displaced and otherwise would die or become sick, and because they don't have a roof over their head, they don't have a place to go, and it's still raining, it's still flooding when they're caught in that. So if you did this in every one of the areas so that you spread them out, so no given area is without it, and the greatest number of these go in where the greatest number of people, for $1 billion, you could see that every single displaced person from earthquakes and from flooding and drought would have a place to go and have food and shelter and hygiene and medical care. That would be the right way to spend that money. Giving a check as we do now is the wrong way. Did I not criticize as totally and completely corrupt Karzai in Afghanistan or Maliki in Iraq? And look what they just said today in the New York Times. Bagfuls of cash are given to him by Iran, and bagfuls of cash are given by America. And that money doesn't go to help anybody except him and his corrupt family. How long do they think Americans who are out of work and unemployed and paying for those bags full of money will tolerate that and yet continue to sacrifice Americans and innocent civilians in that cause? What else?
All right, Gary. Well, this is also having to do with Iraq, but they actually are now in the southern province of Basra, and they are actually having to build a hospital because the amount of children who are having cancer, leukemia, and other types of diseases caused by depleted uranium has four times the amount of kids now under the ages of 15 are getting cancer, and that's why they are building this hospital. Do you think that there is a way for them to prevent it, or...
No. I predicted this In fact, that was in Gulf War Syndrome, Killing Our Own, the film, where at the end of the film I showed all those hundreds of children who died from rare cancers. And we refused to acknowledge the effects of depleted uranium in Yugoslavia when we bombed it. And mind you, it doesn't stay where you bomb it. It's very light. It goes everywhere. So all of the Middle East is now contaminated. In fact, they actually picked up depleted uranium in England at a sensory station that was able to pick up air atmospheric radiation and depleted uranium. No, it will be there for over 3 billion years, and it will cause nothing but more cancers and birth defects.
Yeah. Thanks, Gary.
No, there's no good outcome to that.
Well, do you have time for one more, or do you want to take some
calls? One more.
Okay, this last one is also something that was mentioned a while ago, but it's the newest WikiLeaks document that's being released right now is about the political alignment between al-Sadr and the Iraqi Prime Minister al-Malik, and how they are working together to... I mean, pretty much for political alliances, and it's made a new Iraqi government, and Malik and Sadr are working together, and this doesn't mean good things for the U.S. And
well, I predicted this on this show 6 months ago. If you remember, I said that the most powerful person in the future of Iraq is not Maliki, it was Muqtada Sadr, who was in Iran, studying to be a mullah, as was his father, but under the full tutelage of the Iranian mullahs and their government. So now we see it. Now he has come forward. Maliki and Muqtada Sadr, but that means Muqtada Sadr will have more power, and he also has his army. And that means that we will have a theocracy where he is the power, and controlling him will be the Iranian mullahs and the Shia. That means that you will see an enormous amount of sectarian violence against the Sunni. That means that virtually everything we have done in Iraq will be for nothing. Nothing. It'll all be wiped away. All of it. All the military bases. Everything will be gone the moment this guy officially takes power, which will be in the next 12 to 24 months. And that means that Iran now will have the power not only of its presence, but it will also control Iraq. They're both Shia. Now, Saudi Arabia will be working behind the scenes to continue supplying the Sunni, and then you'll have the Sunni against the Shia, and then you'll have a massive bloodbath, unlike anything we've even seen in the sectarian violence of the past. But you would have heard that here on the show over 6 months ago.
Thanks, Gary.
Let's say hello to... Chris from Long Island. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Gary. How you doing?
Doing great.
First off, I just want to say thank you for the great show. I've been taking a bunch of notes and learning how to eat properly. And my question is about supplementation.
Sure.
And I've been slowly building my my regimen of supplementation as per your suggestions and whatnot. And it's getting to be a lot of things, and I was wondering, like, should I be, when you're taking all these supplements, how do you time it out during the day and best times to take it or
throw
the take,
it's
not
very
take?
It's very, very simple. Throw them all in a blender in the morning, because it's easier on digestion when you have the essential fatty acids and you have your sulfur bearing nutrients and you have your vitamin C. Throw it all in, blend it up, and then have that smoothie twice in a day. Have it in the morning. That'll give you your fiber, essential fatty acids, your B complex. It'll give you your protein, and then have it in the late afternoon, a glass. That will give you a sustained energy until dinner, and but won't adversely affect your appetite. That's the best way of doing it. All the best to you, Chris. Let's say hello now to Gene from Vermont. Hi, Gene.
Thank you for all you do. I was curious, you've mentioned a number of times that you believe Hillary is going to be the next president.
It's not a belief. You could bet your life on it. It's going to happen.
I would totally agree with you, but I don't understand how your timeline, because if she's the next president, still Obama has another 4 years because he's the incumbent.
No, he only has 2 years. Here's what's going to happen. First, understand why would she give up being a New York State Senator, which gives her far more public power than Secretary of State. Remember, as Secretary of State, you do the bidding of the President. You cannot act unilaterally. But what she lacked in her campaign against Obama was the strength of a resume showing that she could deal in international relationships. She had none of that. And when you're the first wife and you're traveling really as a goodwill ambassador. You're not making policy. You're not sitting and dealing in arms negotiations, prisoner release, environmental issues. So now that she is Secretary of State, she has that. So she has done enough to show that she can meet with all different types of parties all over the world. Next, her and her husband are political animals. They live for power. They're the type of people that only exist in relationship to what other people do to acknowledge that. Unfortunately, they both come from that best and brightest background of believing that they are smarter than other people. They are not. And that they are able to guide people. They do not. If you looked at their policies, they are both corporate America pundits completely. He did more to cause the damage today than any human being on the planet. He was not a hedge fund or an equity partnership. He wasn't George Soros or one of the other people like Paulson who actually manipulated the money, but he took away the restrictions in the Glass-Steagall Act and modified the Commodity Future Trading Act that allowed them to, in effect, steal America blind. Now, even after all the bad things he did on the environment, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, weakening environmental issues across the board, not signing the Kyoto Agreement, and going for the eviscerating the unions, causing the outsourcing of millions of jobs by supporting the World Trade Organization and NAFTA and GATT, now he is going through redemption time. Well, that gives her the perfect opportunity to say, okay, looking at the future, after this coming election, the Republicans will take back the House. May or may not take back the Senate. I doubt it, but certainly the House. That means now that the President will veto anything they put through, but they will absolutely block any legislation he can. So you're going to see the 2 years of nothing getting done in Congress at all. Nothing. So that means that Barack Obama will be a one-term candidate. I would expect by next summer that you will hear, amongst all the turmoil and all of the friction, a gaining in the Tea Party, because they'll try to take the credit for getting the Republicans into position. And remember, only about 10% of the Tea Party members right now are supportive of the right wing, of the Sarah Palins and some of the other people. The vast majority are simply independents who are so frustrated that they went out to align themselves with a movement that did not have leadership and did not have platforms. They were just angry at how the government was acting out. The Democrats had a chance to get ahead of that group and say, we will provide some leadership and show you how to regain a sense of checks and balances. They chose not to. They chose instead to ridicule and mock them, not realizing how big it would be. And so now you're going to have nothing but gridlock. In that, it gives the perfect opportunity for Hillary Clinton then to say by next summer, I've done all I can to help. She'll show some minor successes. And then she will say, I can best help the Democrats by revitalizing the Democrats. And then all the people who had formerly been with Clinton in the past, all of them, will be there because they were all there for Obama. It's amazing to imagine that this president went against everything he said. He said no business like the old business going to happen, all new faces. He didn't have one single new face. They were all former Clinton people. So Clinton's been controlling his White House. Ron Emanuel, Larry Summers, Timothy Geithner. These were all former Clinton appointees. So Clinton will have her entire machine behind her, and then she will start advocating that she is the new populist. There's nothing populist in these people. They are elitist. But they lie. We're going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience and continue on the Progressive Radio Network. Go to Gary Knoll or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Now she will try to get the disenfranchised African Americans, the Latinos, to believe in her. She'll try to go heavily towards the women. And she will try to pick up as many women saying, well, we've had a black, now let's have a woman. And after that, and she will probably bring in someone who is Latino as her vice president. Remember, they're purely Machiavellians. And she will have a kind of a rainbow coalition around her. So the average person will think, oh, thank goodness, we have someone to take us out of our... By that time, by next summer, we will be seeing the dollar depreciated because of the BRIC countries getting away from the American dollar, the monetizing the American dollar into the trillions. There must be another stimulus plan. It will be at least $1 trillion, but no one's going to allow it to go through. The Fed will continue to spend money, probably over another $1 trillion. None of that will go to the average person. And so when people wake up one day, they're going to see substantial deflation. They'll see the value of their homes down 20 to 50%, the value of the dollar down, their purchasing power down. They'll see more foreclosures. All the while, at no time, except by making promises, there'll be no one stepping in to stop foreclosures. And by the time Barack Obama wakes up, to the consequences that he was a good, outstanding politician and a terrible, terrible person to be president, it'll be too late for him. He'll have probably 80% of his cabinet will abandon him in the next 12 months. And then Clinton will rise. I wouldn't even be surprised to see someone, Clinton bringing in another African American, like a Colin Powell, but Colin Powell wouldn't go with her. But like a Colin Powell, acceptable to everybody. And that's why Hillary will be the next president. That's what I believe. I believe it's almost self-evident unless something changes that scenario. That's what I see. Okay?
Okay, but I didn't understand how Obama would wave. I thought the incumbent was automatically the next Democratic candidate. That's what I thought.
Absolutely not.
Oh,
never.
Thank you.
No. You have to go to the convention and win.
Oh, I thought just because he was the incumbent, he had that right.
No. He has the right to run again. Yes, and he has the inside track if he has power and popularity.
Her.
Absolutely.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Bye.
Let's say hello to James from Long Island. Hi, James.
Hello, Gary. I'm calling about the fact that I'm coming up to having a cruise in which I'll be away for 7 days, and I'd like to take the powders and have them to have as many meals, and I'm concerned that there will be some kind of problem with me taking them in little packets. Is there a problem with that?
I have not had any problem. I put mine, because I take so much, I put them in gallon freezer bags. And then I take a label and I stick it on the outside. And I've had people say, what are these? And I say, that's a protein powder, and that's a vegetable powder, and that's a fruit powder. And they'll say, okay. And I've never had anyone confiscate them. I've never had anyone, do anything to them. Or you can keep them in the jars, in which case, and you won't have any problem.
Okay, but they should be, if they're in a packet, labeled. Now, is there a problem if I take one of those little mini blenders and use water to mix it up?
Not at all.
Because I'm not sure if they'll have soy or rice milk on, because I'm going on, like I said, a cruise.
Well, they'll always have apple juice.
Oh, okay.
And
apple
juice? Orange juice, apple juice, grapefruit juice, they have those.
Okay, so then there shouldn't be any problem.
I've never had a problem, including last year when I was on a cruise. I had about 1,200 people on a health cruise, and we went out for a week. Nice group of people, by the way. And it's nice because at nighttime they all get dressed up. You go table to table and talk with people. And it was just a lot of fun. And I've never had a problem, and there's no reason you should either, all right?
That sounds good.
Unless they see you with one of the powders sniffing in your nose, then they're going to set you aside. Then they're going to do a whole body scan on you, all right?
Great. Okay.
All the best to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye. Let's say hello to Virginia from Virginia.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
You had mentioned earlier, you talked about coenzyme Q10, but you had mentioned that it needed to be taken with something else.
To be an even more absorbed, a greater absorbability.
Uh-huh.
For every time you take coenzyme Q10, take 20 milligrams of NADH.
NADH?
Yes.
And what is that?
That is a energy precursor and will stimulate more release of ATP, adenosine triphosphate, into the cell. So it's just a good co-catalyst, much like quercetin or the bioflavonoids are co-catalysts to vitamin C.
Okay, right. And that's in your one of your powder ingredients?
Yeah.
Okay, well, great. I have that. Okay,
all the
and I wanted to ask you one more question.
Yeah.
Everybody is, you know, fed up with the two-party system, but I don't. I hear you saying we should go progressive
and have a third party.
And have a third party, but we need, you know, the political people to come forward, and we need to see names on ballots.
Okay, we don't have that now, and we won't. That's why I say you
until
have...
Until after Clinton.
You have to have Clinton fail.
Yeah.
Here's the irony. Uh-huh. She will be president because of how they manipulate the press and because how stupid most Americans are.
Yeah.
When it comes to not looking at the totality of what they're doing.
Yeah.
But her failure and the failure of the economy and the failure of our institutions will mean that a third party led by real progressives will mean that we will now have the strength of a third party because there are more independents than liberals and Democrats combined. All right, so
and they need to be at the state level also.
They need to be at all levels.
Right.
And by that time, there'll be a whole momentum where the people who are now, you never see them.
You're right.
You never see them invited in into discussions. All right?
Okay. All right, thank you.
All right. That's all the time I have right now, but in 2 hours, I'll be back with a whole lot more to share and hopefully the truth behind the thimerosal aluminum vaccine autism connection. I haven't had a chance to get to that yet, but we will. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day. Stay tuned for our next program here on the Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.